In the matter of Juan Morales Hurtado versus Albo Reynoso, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. Ishaka Miller from Goldberg Segala for defending petitioner, and with me is my partner, Lou Berndar, from the assistant petitioner.
Good morning. Martin Sedzidlow, J.D. Blum, on behalf of the plaintiff, Juan Morales Hurtado.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jonathan Muguro, on behalf of New Jersey.
Welcome, counsel. This case has a large number of issues. It would be most helpful if you could structure your arguments to address the following: secondary gain, life care expert, and testimony about the airbag. You're certainly welcome to touch on other areas, and our questions may well delve into other areas, but it would be helpful if you focused on those and restructured your arguments accordingly. Mr. Miller.
Chief Justice, Associate Justices, Counsel, may it please the Court. Before I address the substance, Your Honor obviously noted there are a number of issues. I would like, if the Court would be so willing, to reserve perhaps 3 minutes at the end for rebuttal if necessary. Your Honors, we're here today to ask this Court to reverse the decision of the Appellate Division and to restore the jury award, the jury verdict, in this matter. And remind the Court that this was a verdict for the plaintiff that resulted in a gross award of about $121,000 and a net award of a little bit over $100,000. The reason we ask Your Honors to do that is because the trial was fair. It may not have been perfect, but it was fair. In reversing the jury verdict and remanding for a new trial, the Appellate Division did not identify any particular error or errors that it found to be harmful. There was no particular error that was identified as being clearly capable of producing an unjust result. Rather, the Appellate Division identified a collection of about a dozen or so issues or errors that it accumulated to find, in its view, that the plaintiff did not get a fair trial. Some of the issues that the Appellate Division addressed were objected to at trial and were raised on appeal by the plaintiff, but many of them were not. They were neither objected to nor raised on appeal by the plaintiff. Now, certainly the Appellate Division is correct, right, that an appellate court may, in the interest of justice, notice plain error not brought to the attention of the trial or appellate court. I'm not suggesting the Appellate Division couldn't do what it did. However, it's also, I think, clear and true that it's not generally the role of an appellate court to go hunting through a trial record to try to find unraised errors to accumulate. In fact, I would submit that the Appellate Division opinion reads not unlike an academic law school evaluation in a trial advocacy class, perhaps from the context of a professor critiquing the performance of a student, or perhaps a student doing an issue-spotting essay to identify all potential errors that may have been made at a trial. But I think Your Honors will recognize when you read, you probably have already read the Appellate Division opinion, that it focuses on the alleged misdeeds, if I could use that word, of the defense attorney, while making virtually no effort whatsoever to identify whether plaintiff's counsel also committed any infraction. When the court is accumulating a series of small, even to some extent, technical errors by one side to determine if there is enough to constitute cumulative error, shouldn't the court have done that for both sides? So in other words, instead of just accumulating the perceived errors by the defense counsel and the trial court that, in the Appellate Division's mind, were detrimental to the plaintiff, shouldn't the Appellate Division have also examined the trial record for any potential perceived errors by plaintiff's counsel or the trial court that benefited the plaintiff. It didn't happen here. Of the dozen or so errors identified, some to be more significant than others, I was planning on focusing on several. They're the same ones, Chief Justice, that you identified. But I submit that when we look at all these errors, those three that you've called out as well as the other ones, I think you will find that many, if not all, were not actually error, and that to the extent that you still believe there may have been a few small ones that you agree with the appellate division that were erroneous, they do not rise to the level of harmful error, either singly or in combination. And for those reasons, we ask that your honors would vacate the appellate division opinion and restore the jury verdict. I'll start, if it's okay with your honors, with the first issue of secondary gain. This was one of the three primary issues on which we moved for certification. And again, I will note that the questioning that was the subject of the appellate division's opinion took place at the Debene essay deposition of one of the plaintiff's experts. And at the time of that Debene essay deposition, no objection was raised to those questions at the time of the Debene essay, although I will acknowledge that there was a pretrial application made by plaintiff's counsel to excise some of those questions.
Was there a basis in the record, either the documentary evidence or any of the medical testimony, that supported the introduction of the theory of secondary gain in this trial?
There was no affirmative evidence from any of the doctors on the defense side, but I do believe, Your Honor, that it is within the bounds of challenging and opposing experts' view to ask if they have considered certain things, and by laying the foundation with a plaintiff's expert to ask if he was familiar with the topic and whether that was something that was generally recognized.
If this is a rule of law, it would permit a defense attorney to ask every single medical expert, okay, isn't it the case that the patient might be doing this because he's greedy and wants a larger verdict? That's basically the tenor, context of all that questioning. I don't see where this goes. If that's permissible here, then I don't see why it wouldn't be permissible everywhere. And if it's permissible everywhere, doesn't it have the great potential to divert the minds of the jury from really the evidence?
I don't agree with Your Honor, because I think if I could take a step back to the focus of this court in the Walmart Rodriguez matter, which obviously was, I think, pending certification before this court at the time we filed our petition, and raises many of the same issues.
Dealing with the that was dealing with psychological, psychiatric testimony. This cross-examination has taken this to a whole new level, where any medical expert on the stand, where I guess there's any sort of subjective complaint, can just ask the expert, hey, have you ever heard of this concept, secondary gain, where the plaintiff is just making it all up because he wants a lot of money? That's basically what that line of argument is.
Honor, I don't believe that is inappropriate, because in this situation you have a plaintiff who is making admittedly...
Isn't that a query, an improper argumentative question? You could get the same information without touching secondary gain, touching the plaintiff's motion, saying, doctor, the patient referred to certain symptoms. Did you perform any tests that objectively indicated the symptoms existed? And without getting into secondary gain mitigation, the minute you start talking about secondary gain, isn't that an argumentative question and clearly improper?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and I think it may be semantics. It may be getting at the same thing.
That's not semantics. It's about what the jury's hearing.
I understand that, Your Honor. And I think that the focus and the concern of this court with the Walmart versus Rodriguez opinion was an expert giving an opinion, which we all understand the jury may give more weight to, but giving an opinion that the plaintiff is being untruthful or some witness is being untruthful. And I recognize there is certainly well-established law that says witness can't comment on the veracity of another witness. But that's not what was happening here. And I think that the questions that were asked here are much less troublesome than the questions that were asked.
Let me read your question.
Sure.
So doctors such as yourself understand that a patient such as Mr. Morales might have a motive to make complaints because he feels those complaints might result in the receipt of monetary compensation. Is that correct? That brings out the credibility of witness, motivation. There's no basis other than your argument for that because you haven't brought up by way of foundation that some tests are negative, that type of thing. So
I understand.
Disabuse you of the notion that that's not an improper question.
Your Honor, the plaintiff is coming in and making subjective complaints of discomfort or whatever it is, and the examining doctor expert is relying on the veracity of those complaints.
So you can limit it to that. And following up on Justice Fernandez-Vina's, you're dressing this up as science, too. So I'll just, one of the questions, and the concept of secondary gain is one that is generally understood and accepted in the medical profession, correct? Yes. It's well known to the medical profession that plaintiffs will lie in order to get more money in a damages award. That's what it's saying, no? Am I?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I don't think it is that blatant because there are other factors that may get into the concept of secondary gain. I don't think it is defined in the medical literature as plaintiffs lying to get more money. I think there can be other aspects to that, and here the questioning laid the foundation because the question asked the medical doctor, is this a concept with which you are familiar that is recognized in the medical field?
You draw a distinction between asking a question of a witness, doctor, have you found organic reasons that support the symptoms this person has complained and go through it that way, as compared to what happened here?
I think it's a matter of style. I think ultimately it gets you to the same place. And I don't think it's a problem. Because, and the reason I don't think it's a problem, Your Honor, is because if we look at the concern as addressed by the court in Walmart versus Rodriguez, which is, you know, asking an expert to say, I believe plaintiff X is lying about whatever. That is of more concern for the jury system than asking the doctor who relied on the plaintiff's subjective complaints, are you aware of this possibility? The plaintiff may not be being fully truthful or accurate with you, maybe embellishing, maybe discounting,
questions.
Whatever.
Two questions.
Yes, sir.
What was that question based on, number one? And number two, you just admitted for, I think, the third time that it was an effort to use the plaintiff's expert to impeach the credibility of the plaintiff. Could you explain that away for me? So you answer the first question first. What did you base that question on? Did your expert talk about secondary gain?
The defense counsel, Your Honor, I didn't try the case, but the defense counsel did not have an affirmative opinion from any of the defense experts.
So what was it based on?
It was based on the belief and the argument that the plaintiff was making more of this accident and more of his injuries.
All right, then get to the second question, because now you're attacking. The whole purpose of that, there's no reason you can't say, were there any objective, as Justice Fernandez-Vina said, were there any objective findings? What did the test reveal? You didn't find this, you didn't find that, you didn't find. I think the jury understands it's a lawsuit for money damages. If they don't, you're going to tell them. What was the reason for the inquiry about secondary gain, other than to use an expert, plaintiff's expert here, without a foundation, to undermine the credibility of the plaintiff?
I think, Your Honor, it was to get at the topic and the argument that this expert for plaintiff, who also, I think, admitted that he did not review all of the records in reaching his opinion, that
nothing wrong with that.
Okay, that took plaintiff's complaints at face value and asking whether the doctor, that expert, considered in his diagnosis, in his expert opinion.
No, I get all that. You use the words, you can make all the arguments you made to us in opening and closing, even in your examination and cross-examination of the various experts. You were basically saying to the doctor, tell the jury, doctor, that the plaintiff lied to you.
Well, actually, I don't think so, Your Honor, because okay. I don't think that there was a question from either side to Dr. Do you believe?
No.
Right?
You don't have to ask that question. That's going to be a problem, and okay. I don't think any lawyer is going to be seated while that question's asked.
Okay. But again, Your Honor, I don't believe that inquiring as to the basis of the expert's opinion, which obviously you're allowed to challenge, when the expert is accepting, potentially uncritically, the subjective complaints, did the expert consider the fact that this is a recognized...
You just want to be able to ask the medical expert, did you ever think that the plaintiff might just be greedy? You might as well just put it that way. That's what secondary gain is all about, no?
I don't think it's quite that blatant and as stark, Your
Honor. Of course, because you're dressing it up, so it won't be that blatant. I got it.
Why don't we move on to the life care expert?
Okay. Moving on to the life care issue, Your Honors, I think that the, and I'll start by noting that the appellate division, as I read the opinion, did not conclude that the trial court was wrong in precluding the life care expert, but simply sent it back for, I think, clarification of what I believe to be the appellate division's misunderstanding of the basis of the trial court's ruling.
So the question for our discussion now is, was there sufficient basis to allow that testimony in, and if not, why not?
And I think that is exactly the question, Your Honor, and the answer is no, because I think as was illuminated during the 104 hearing, it became very clear that the opinions about future medical care requirements for the plaintiff that the life care expert relied upon as the basis to then do what she did, which is calculate the cost for those things.
Have you ever cross-examined a life care planner yourself?
Excuse me?
Have you ever cross-examined a life care planner yourself?
I have, Your Honor.
Isn't that what they all testified to? They call the hospitals in the area and find out how much a procedure will cost. They could call another hospital and do an index of it. They provide no opinion of from their own knowledge. That's what they do. They get a basis and an average. That's the basis of the report, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor.
So how did that the report here differ from that?
That's a different question, Your Honor, than the one the Chief Justice asked, I think. I will try to address both of them. To address Your Honor's point, yes, a life care planner, once the life care planner has a basis on which to believe that plaintiff needs X procedure, then the life care planner is going to go out into the market and determine what the projected cost for that will be.
You're saying that the worst she got to that point through leading self-serving questions on those questionnaires, which are, as I understand it, would this person need this, would they need that, and that even if you don't allow in those questionnaires, she's still going to be able to testify relying on inherently unreliable information.
Exactly, Your Honor, because James versus Ruiz, as we all know, limits the ability of right, a party to use one expert to get in expert opinion from another expert. And here, the opinions about what the plaintiff would need medically in the future could not come from the life care expert because she's not a doctor.
What about Ryan versus KDI Pools? Doesn't that out expert testimony and facts generally relied upon by experts even if it's not in evidence? Isn't that the holding of Ryan versus KDI Pools?
I believe it is, Your Honor. I don't think that matters here because what plaintiff was trying to do through the life care expert was to get into, in front of the jury, those medical opinions that the plaintiff's medical experts would not have been able to give about the future medical needs because those were not in the experts' reports. They were not in the experts' underlying medical records, those who were treaters. So I think that was clear that the trial judge was focused on that in the 104 because the trial court asked plaintiff's counsel a number of times, what is the basis for these expert opinions medically that the plaintiff's going to need X, Y, and Z?
So and you've done this before, so maybe you can help us and certainly help me. The questionnaires that are at issue here, do you know whether or not they're regularly used by life care experts in order to extrapolate what the future medical needs maybe. And that goes to the question is this underlying data that is customarily used by life care experts?
Your Honor, speaking from experience, the life care experts that I have examined have not done that. I know the life care expert in this case testified, I believe, in the 104 hearing that it was part of the normal practice. But I think that the more important inquiry is the information that the life care expert gleaned from those questionnaires, which admittedly were prepared for the purpose of litigation and so forth, the information that she gleaned from those questionnaires reflected medical opinions about future care that plaintiff's medical experts would not otherwise have been able to say, would not otherwise have been able to present to the jury.
So if you had a situation where someone was left as a paraplegic after an accident, the normal life care process would take point, the beginning point would be that this person can't walk and can't do all of these things, and that would be developed independent of the life care expert. You're saying that to get to what is normally point A, this life care expert has essentially imported opinions of sorts in response to a questionnaire about future medical needs that are way beyond her expertise and aren't actually part of anybody else's testimony.
Right. I think if the plaintiff's medical experts had given the opinions in their reports, or in Dr. Argentino's the Benny essay deposition or wherever, if that had been otherwise information and opinions that the jury would have heard, then there would have been the factual basis for the life care expert to get over that first hurdle, which is there a medical basis for these opinions?
You're saying that the record does not reflect any testimony that this plaintiff would require future medical treatments and ancillary care?
That is correct, Your Honor. This was asked a number of times of plaintiff's counsel during the 104 hearing, and plaintiff's counsel struggled to provide that basis. Dr. Argentino, I apologize to the doctor if I'm mispronouncing his name, in his DeBene essay was asked about future medical treatment, this, I think, is perhaps in the part of his DeBene essay that wasn't transcribed in the trial record, so I have an appendix site for Your Honor at DA 109. It says, quote, it's possible that he will need it, but I wouldn't say within a reasonable degree of medical probability. Dr. Lawler testified, and this is the transcript, January 4th, beginning on about page 61, question, do you anticipate Mr. Hurtado would need some sort of future medical care for his neck and his thoracic spine? And I'll note that that doctor last treated the plaintiff more than 3 years before the trial. And his answer was, he may require an epidural if it flares up again, like I had mentioned the last time I saw him, and same with the thoracic. You know, generally we try not to do thoracic surgery if we can avoid it at all cost. All of the important structures, the heart, the lungs, are in the thoracic, so we start off with epidurals in that area.
No expert opine within a reasonable degree of medical probability is required that there be a requirement for future treatment.
Correct, Your Honor. And there are other examples, I don't have them all cataloged here, but there are other examples in the 104 asking about certain medications that were, I think, identified in the life care plan, and the life care expert was challenged as to what was the basis. Did the doctor say the plaintiff needed those medications? And I think she admitted that that was not the case.
But her questionnaires essentially were, at least as I see it, tell me if I'm wrong, were designed to get as many yes answers as possible. Get a bunch of yes answers and then testify, well, he'll need this, he'll need that, he'll need the other thing. Even if you directly ask the doctor, under the expert's standard, that doctor apparently would have backed off and said, I don't have an opinion on that.
That's my impression as well, Your Honor. And also, just in the process of those questionnaires, it's not clear necessarily that the information in the questionnaires came from the doctor in all cases, as opposed to, I think at least in one of the situations, it refers to having spoken to the doctor's staff. Some of them, I think, were signed at the bottom, presumably by the by the doctors, but there was different handwriting on them and so forth. So I think overall, when the trial court did what, you know, this court has instructed trial courts to do in a 104 hearing, which is, you know, assess the methodology and the underlying information in a 104 hearing, the trial court did that and determined that there was enough problem here that the court thought, on balance, it was inappropriate and unfairly prejudicial to the defendant to let the life care expert come in and talk about all these things. So I think it's a discretionary decision, Your Honors, that the appellate division really afforded no discretion to, because I think the appellate division either misapprehended the basis of the ruling or focused on certain aspects that I think may have been taken out of context. The appellate division talks about whether the opinions from the doctor were certified, and that was a big focus of the trial court's determination. I think that misses the point of that exchange in the trial record, which is that plaintiff's counsel, I think, suggested to the trial court that the doctors had certified those questionnaires, and I think the trial court was noting that they were not certifications the way attorneys are accustomed to doing the certifications with the language from the court rule at the bottom, but that they were simply, you know, signed off on by the doctor. So I think the appellate division misunderstood, if you will, you know, the trial court's use of the word certification there.
Let's move on to the question about testimony relating to airbags.
Certainly. And on the airbag issue, Your Honor, I'll note that, and I'm sure Your Honors have noted this as well, there was no objection at the trial court level to this testimony, and it was relatively brief, innocuous questioning about whether the airbag deployed.
And the suggestion from that innocuous question is, couldn't have been so bad because the airbag didn't go off, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but it might also get to the fact that there was no impact between the airbag and the plaintiff. I think the plaintiff was also asked, you know, did he strike his head anywhere inside the vehicle? I've never been in an accident with an airbag deploying. Fortunately, I hope none of your honors have either.
If it were that innocuous, why was the question also asked whether or not the bus's airbags went off?
I missed that question in the record, Your Honor. I will believe you tell me it's there. I missed that in the record. I did not see that any question was asked about the bus.
Right after the one that you brought up that we asked you about, and no airbag deployed on the bus either, correct? I didn't observe that.
Okay.
What's the speed for a rear impact that would set off an airbag?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Can it?
So how?
I don't know, Your Honor. I'm not an expert.
So how would a jury be able to assess the testimony?
Well, the jury is able to look at photographs. The jury is allowed to see photographs in this particular case showing no airbag deployment. And I think this is an issue where there may well be situations and there may be expert considerations about whether you can make certain arguments about airbag deployment and inferences therefrom. But I would suggest, Your Honor, not on this record, because there is no record. Because as I started, there was no objection to the question. It wasn't raised on appeal. It was brought up sua sponte by the appellate division based on a subsequent law division opinion that happened after this trial that wasn't the subject of an appeal. So effectively what the appellate division did was affirm the Tang case that wasn't appealed in the context of this case without any briefing or argument by anybody until now.
Is it appropriate, for the purposes of our opinion, is it appropriate for counsel to ask a question in this fashion?
I believe it is, Your Honor.
Tell us why.
Because the photographs were in evidence. The jury could see the photographs. Jury can also look at the extent of the physical damage to a car, and they're allowed to do that without expert testimony.
I think there's a difference between the photographs and the deployment of the airbags, because deployment of the airbags may require some form of expert testimony. It may very well be where this particular car was hit in the rear that the airbag never deploys. And if that is the case, then your predecessor trial attorney was able to get before the juries something that isn't true to suggest that the accident wasn't really serious.
Go ahead, answer your question.
Your Honor, the jury was going to figure that out anyway when they looked at the pictures, that the airbag had not deployed. And also, you talk about, you know, physical damage and so forth. I'm not an engineer, but my understanding is that vehicles are, particularly increasingly these days, constructed in a way with crumple zones and ways to avoid or reduce impact and biomechanical forces to occupants.
Why do we care about any of that? Did you have an expert testify to that? Why do we care about any of that? Did you have an expert testify about that at trial? How is what you're arguing in any way relevant to anything we're considering?
Because, Your Honor, this was not an issue that was on anyone's radar at the trial.
You're arguing about the configurations of motor vehicles and modern technology like airbags and the impact. What does that have to do with anything unless you have an expert testify to that at trial and it's an issue before us? What do we care?
I think, Your Honor, it's relevant because if the court is going to affirm the appellate division on this issue and establish what seems to be a per se rule that you can't say anything about an airbag unless you have an expert,
What would be wrong with that rule, counsel?
Excuse me?
What would be wrong with that rule? It would keep the jury from guessing because there's a jury charge on photographs saying some people are severely injured in low-impact accidents, some people are not in high-impact accidents. That's part of jury charge. You say, an appellate division opinion written by Judge Perella that said that you couldn't put the photograph without an expert. But you're having the jury guess, and you yourself said, you started your argument, say, I'm not an engineer. Well, neither are the jurors unless you've actually selected some that are. So you're having them guess as to the speeds and the impact and what how serious it was. But beyond that, you're not having the jury guess as to what injuries would have occurred with or without the airbag. And there's a similar case called Waterson on seatbelts where you need an expert. So how is that when you started your answer by saying, I'm not an engineer? I'm assuming jurors aren't either.
I agree, Your Honor. And I'll get back to what I said before, but there's no record here. And if Your Honors are going to impose a per se rule on a case where there's no record.
We didn't say what we're going to do. We're just asking the questions.
Sure.
Okay.
I said if Your Honors are going to impose a per se rule. I didn't say you were. I'm sorry.
Okay. Is the bottom line on your position regarding this airbag issue that this is a simple fact? You can ask plaintiff, did it go off or not without needing an expert? Is that really all you're asking this court to consider?
I'm asking Your Honor to consider that and also whether in the context of this particular case, whether this question in this case led to an unfair result, either singly or in combination. And I think the answer to that is no, it didn't. And that's why I keep coming.
How about answer the first question that Justice posed?
Sorry?
The first question. Is it a simple factual question that you're eliciting from a witness, did the airbag deploy or not? Is that a fair question?
Yes.
I assume nobody would really contest that it's fair to say, did the airbag go off when it did go off, when a plaintiff is describing what happened.
Right. The airbag deployed and a person deployed, was asked, did it deploy?
People testify all the time the airbag deployed, right?
Yes.
And they're asked all the time, did the airbag deploy?
Yes.
What's different, I suppose, about this is that the possibility that this was intended to have an expert component to it in the sense that if it didn't go off, does that show it was under 35 miles an hour or 45 miles an hour, whatever it may be? And that content wasn't there from the expert.
I think it was part of the overall evidence about the relatively low impact nature of this accident. This was not the only evidence of that.
Was it cited in summation, that question?
Yes, it was, briefly, but it was cited in summation.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you'd like to add to your presentation?
No, Your Honors. Thank you very much.
We'll have you back for rebuttal. Mr. Sedzilla.
Chief Justice, Justices, thank you. Obviously, I have a different opinion. I do believe the appellate division was correct in ordering a new trial. I think the trial was patently unfair for numerous reasons. I think a new trial would be warranted simply because of the life care plan issue because it prevented the jury from getting a full damage picture. If someone, for example, had testified that I missed 2 years of work and I had economic loss, and the judge says, well, I'm not going to let anybody hear about your economic loss.
Well, but this is a different issue. You would concede there are lots of ways for experts to create opinions, and as I understand what went on with the 104 hearing, there was a real concern about an expert who admittedly didn't have the expertise, any kind of medical expertise, importing a maybe opinion that could have been represented nothing more than that a medical office got a form and an assistant just checked some things off and handed it to the doctor, didn't understand that there was some sort of opinion being given.
I don't believe that's the case,
Counselor,
Your Honor.
Your hypothesis is off, because you started by saying you could testify that you have income loss. And of course, that's just a function of taxes, what you're paid. You're not talking to the future. You can't say that without a vocational expert and an actuary that testifies to the ranges, reduced for inflation,
so,
which is what they're seeking here. You're talking about future treatment. If the life care plan had talked about here's what he had in the past, here's what it cost, that's a whole different story. So your hypothesis is off. We're talking future here, not present.
My hypothesis was that not allowing the life care planner testify is akin to not allowing economic loss. And I agree with you. The plaintiff would have to testify, I haven't worked. You would have to bring in a vocational expert and an economist.
But don't the vocational expert's opinions have to be based on something, either
of course,
and federal data, government data as to rate of employment? What was this based? The argument here is not that she couldn't testify, that life care practice couldn't testify, but rather that the opinions are flawed because they're not based on any facts that could be provable.
I don't believe that's true, because Dr. Argentiano was testifying in the case. He was one of the doctors who treated the plaintiff, performed surgery, and filled out one of the questionnaires. Dr. Lawler actually testified.
Did Argentino and the other expert, either in a Debeney essay or in testimony, did any of your witnesses say, within a reasonable degree of medical certainty, the plaintiff is going to require treatment into the future for this, that, and the other thing? Is there any of that?
Yes, Your Honor, that they, in their reports, Dr. Lawler says in his report.
Okay, go ahead. I don't want to cut you off, but that went before the jury. Go ahead.
Dr. Lawler, in his report, said that I believe there's going to need treatment in the future, which may involve thoracic surgery, it may involve this, he's going to need, that was in his report. Dr. Lawler didn't testify at trial to that because I wasn't allowed to ask him those questions. Judge De La Cruz, the trial judge, barred the life care planner on December 24th, and Dr. Lawler did not come in, I believe, and testify until sometime in January.
But let's talk about absolutely butcher his name, Argentiano, or whatever his name is properly pronounced. He doesn't give the testimony, and yet your life care planner was going to come in and essentially state an opinion based upon an opinion that he declined to make when he was deposed.
He said, while I believe there's a possibility of future surgery, I cannot say that that it's probable.
And we all know that under New Jersey, that's not an expert opinion that could ever be offered to a jury.
I agree.
So you have a backdoor route of that expert opinion getting to the jury, because you admit your expert doesn't have the ability, your life care expert doesn't have any expertise on that.
Well, here's the difference. The reports of the doctors in their narratives are presented 2 years before trial. The life care planner then is hired to talk about what's going to go in the future. Now, experts consult with one another about this. The life care planner, as an expert, consults with the neurosurgeon, consults with the pain management specialist, consults with a physical pain and medicine doctor, and says, how would you like to do this? We have to talk. And some of the doctors say, I prefer to get questionnaires. The expert says, this is something we do.
Did you ever argue that Dr. Lawler will say he requires future thoracic surgery, and here's what it is. Did you ever make that argument at the 104 hearing that our testifying experts will say that this plaintiff requires these treatments in the future?
The trial court did not ask that question.
I'm not, no. In the 104 hearing, before the life care expert was barred for the reason that they were, reasons they were barred, did you or anybody else ever argue, wait a minute, Judge, my doctors, two testifying doctors, will testify as to what treatment, what supports, what they can do and can't do in the future to a reasonable degree of medical certainty?
Honest answer is I don't recall.
Well, if you didn't, how does your life care expert talk about it?
Your Honor, what the reports talk about...
I don't care about the reports.
But the reports say one thing. The life care plan is submitted during discovery a year and a half, if I may, just a year and a half before trial.
Okay.
They now offer, as part of discovery in the case, these opinions that the life care planner says, I have a document that is signed by the doctor.
Okay.
Look at that document. The document, and I understand the doctor wanting to say, send me a questionnaire, whatever, I'll
correct,
fill it out. The doctor may not have had any understanding that that would ever be represented to be an opinion within a reasonable degree of medical certainty that those needs would exist. And the evidence for that is that the one doctor who was directly asked that question said, I don't have that opinion. I think there's possibilities, but recognizing what the standard is, the doctor made clear, I don't have that opinion. So these questionnaires cannot be considered opinions by the doctors.
Well, Dr. Argentiano, since we asked about Dr. Argentiano, who did testify, said, I believe that he will have pain for the rest of his life, and he is going to...
How is that within a reasonable degree of medical probability?
I
believe. How does that fit any standard of reasonable degree of medical probability? I believe that he will have pain in the future. I'm assuming this doctor has testified before. He certainly seemed like he had been answered questions before, so I'm assuming he testified. How does that, I believe he's going to have surgery in the future, in any way, shape, or form, comply with the requirement that it be within a reasonable degree of medical probability?
He says in his report, Your Honor, that I believe he'll have pain for the rest of his life. He then is asked, when he's testifying, I want you to talk about, and will you give all your answers within a reasonable degree of medical probability and not offer opinions that are not within a reasonable degree of medical probability?
Oh, so they need to catch the question?
Yes.
He's asked, will Mr. Hurtado be subject to any future medical treatment as a result of this accident? It's possible that he will need it, but I couldn't say within a reasonable degree of medical probability.
That's what he says.
He doesn't even say in his deposition, the moment when he's being specifically asked a question, I believe he will. He's saying it's possible, and he has the sophistication to recognize the difference between it's possible and an admissible report. That's pretty significant, is it not?
It is.
Would your life care expert have been, had she gotten on the stand, say, oh, and Dr. A, so I don't ruin his name again, also believes or also opines that he will need this. Was that what she would have said?
No, Your Honor. What? Because I think it's also in the record in the 104 hearing where Ms. Simmons Grab, says, I didn't include anything in my report or I don't have anything in my report which the doctors say is not within a reasonable degree of medical probability.
So she's now saying
I am not going to testify about anything that's a mere possibility.
But she's now saying essentially I'm going to get questionnaires and then I'm going to say if they didn't say bells and whistles not within a reasonable degree of medical probability, I'm going to assume that's their opinion within a reasonable degree. And get in that opinion before the jury.
I don't think that was her intention. That certainly isn't what she would have.
I'm not impugning any experts do what they're directed or requested to do by lawyers. I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong with what she was trying to accomplish here, but the fact is that the trial court looked very carefully and saw that there could be a significant lack of reliability of what she was about to say.
What I would say to that, simply, Your Honor, is Ms. Simmons Grab's report was served a year and a half before trial. If there was any question about reliability, is it based upon hearsay or anything else, there was no depositions taken of Dr. Argentiano, there was no deposition taken of Dr. Lola, there was no deposition taken of Ms. Simmons Grab.
They did take it.
Take Lola for 1 second. When you saw you were about to lose your life care expert, did you ever say, wait a second, I got the testimony of Dr. Lawler, who will testify within a reasonable degree of medical probability that the plaintiff is going to suffer from all these things? Did you say that?
Judge, truthfully, that discussion was had after the recording was turned off, and I'd rather not say what the court said to me.
Do you agree that the life care expert cannot get into evidence what doctors told her, whether it's beyond the degree of reasonable degree of medical certainty or not, what doctors told her, but did not say in court or in videotape?
I would tend to agree. Under 703, they're allowed to rely upon hearsay, but they're not allowed to bring in substantive testimony that the doctor did not give himself. I agree with that.
And that's what we're talking about.
Right.
Can you tell us, why wasn't Lawler permitted to testify?
He did testify. He wasn't allowed, but he wasn't allowed to testify about what issue, because the judge made it clear that I'm not going to allow this life care planner, and so I don't want you asking Dr. Lawler about certain questions.
Like what certain questions are you talking about?
Well, I did proffer to the trial court, said, Doctor, if you have concerns about Ms. Simmons Grab's testimony, I can have Dr. Lawler provide that testimony first before she testifies, so it'll be a foundation so that you can see that
when Lola was on the stand, did you pose any questions about the plaintiff's future medical needs through a question that was crafted within a reasonable degree of medical certainty?
I think what Dr. Lola testified to was that his prognosis is poor and he may need some treatment in the future, but that's about it.
May need some treatment?
Yes.
Would you like to move on to the other issues?
Certainly. As far as the airbags, I'll address that quickly. We know, Justice Fernandez-Vina brought up the seatbelt issue. We're not allowed to discuss were injuries made worse or better because a seatbelt was or was not worn under the Waterson case. In that case, where it's a seatbelt, which is simply a mechanical device,
well, you are just required to have expert testimony, and then the juries provide a special sheet that determines seatbelt damages and not seatbelt damages.
Right.
You're allowed to.
This is much more complicated, much more engineered. This is much more complex.
If you had a plaintiff, just a different case. You had a plaintiff where there was a front end collision at an intersection, and the airbag did. Deploy, would you be able to ask your plaintiff, did the airbag deploy?
I shouldn't.
In this case, there were photographs. It was obvious that the airbag had not deployed, correct?
Correct. However, we know from the Brennman case that if you're going to show photographs and you're going to use that to suggest that it's not a severe accident, the court has to give a curative charge to say, look, we're going to let you look at these photographs, but you have to know that this is in no way indicative of, there's no scientific relationship between whether somebody's injured or not injured based upon that. You would have to give that sort of charge if you were going to allow some sort of reference to an airbag or a seatbelt or something else to say, look, just so you know, we're going to let you hear that, but we also have to tell you that. Counsel, argued just a few minutes ago saying, well, Mr. Sedzillo didn't object to the seatbelt question. And again, it's not part of the record, but I've tried 6 to 8 cases before this trial judge. I raised the issue in a prior case with a seatbelt where a defense attorney got up and said, were you wearing your seatbelt? I objected, we went to sidebar, I raised the Waterson case, and the judge said, so what? What's your plaintiff going to say?
Are those really, those are two mechanical devices in cars, but aren't they really analytically for purposes of a negligence action very different? The seatbelt question is asked for purposes of showing you would not have been hurt if you'd been wearing your seatbelt. It's essentially trying to establish some sort of comparative negligence on the part of the plaintiff. Am I right about that? That's the purpose of it when it's
correct.
Asked. And there are all rules about that
correct.
That exist. This is not about the comparative negligence of the plaintiff. As I read this transcript, it looks like the question was asked to infer that the accident was the impact was not so severe.
But you don't need that when you have testimony from the drivers about the speed.
I understand.
This is totally done.
I understand, but all I'm suggesting is that
to ask how many other people on the bus, were they hurt, what are the ages, and the appellate division says there's no rational basis to ask how old the people were.
Yeah, okay, different
it was
question.
All part
but
of
but
this
all I'm saying
larger.
Is that the seatbelt question, it's all about, that's about you were hurt in part because of your own negligence. That's an effort to get some allocation of fault to the plaintiff.
And that the judge in that case told me, I'm going to allow it. I don't see any reason
okay.
to not ask any of these questions. You're being obstructive. And again, all I can say to the collective justices is that this is not my courtroom. This is your courtroom. I am required, as the appellate division points out, to accept the court's rulings and behave like a member of the bar and a professional.
But you raised your objection. I'm trying to figure out this argument. You know, in that prior trial, I had objected, and the objection was sustained, so I decided not to in this case.
No, I was overruled in that case, Judge, so I knew that this was going to fall on deaf ears, and quite
it
honestly,
it doesn't make a difference. We have rules that say that you're required to object, and if you're going to lose, maybe you don't have to go into a whole treatise, but preserve your objection for the record, just in case you have to appeal.
I agree. However, the court puts a chilling effect before we even made our opening statements in the case. I was told, stay quiet, don't say anything.
Is that on the record somewhere?
Yes.
You were told stay quiet?
You were told stay quiet, don't say anything.
Yes.
Could you cite me to the record site?
It was the second or third day of trial, and quite honestly,
did you object to anything in the course of the trial?
Oh, I objected
things, right?
quite a bit.
Okay.
But again, I cannot be seen as a petulant child in front of a jury by objecting every time something happens.
But do you understand that, you know, the reason?
Have you ever heard of, I have a continuing, going up to the sidebar and saying, I have a continuing objection to the design of questioning, Your Honor? Have you ever heard of doing that?
Certainly.
Are you asking us to decide this case on the judge's prior conduct?
Why don't you look for this site later? You can give it to us after.
I have it. I wanted to answer Justice Fina's question, but I do have it bookmarked. Yes, it is from the transcript of day 3 of the trial, December 9th.
I'll give you a chance to come back to this later. I just wanted to have you.
And it is at page 170.
And what is it? Why don't you read it for us?
If I may. I said, the court says, all right, Mr. Sedzillo, I think in the background, behind the scenes, you're also still trying to settle this case, and it does not help to bite the hand that feeds you. So with that in mind, and I understand what you're saying, that Mr. Milford has misrepresented some facts, looked at them the wrong way, misunderstood them, misdescribed them. Let's hear his response, but please stay quiet, Mr. Sidzidlow, at least for your own sake at this point. Now go ahead, Mr. Melber.
That's about an argument. She was telling you, let him argue and stay quiet. She didn't say anything about, for this trial, you're not allowed to speak.
No, Judge, it's larger than that. Again, this was a long trial.
Where did that come? Can you just put that in context? Like, I don't know what preceded that.
This was before, I filed motions in limine. I also had said, and again, I bookmarked this because I just found it unusual, is that anytime I tried to object, the court cut me off, and I said to the court, and I did bookmark it on a different day of trial, where they said, I said, Your Honor, please, I'm trying to make a record here, and you won't let me speak.
That's not what you cited us.
That's a completely different day. Where but that happened throughout, Your Honor.
I can read. I'll find it. Don't worry about it. Continue.
So with this, the seatbelt is a very complex issue. It would require expert testimony.
Airbag.
Yes, an airbag. Thank you, Justice Levesque.
Secondary gain.
The issue of secondary gain. I filed a motion in limine, presented briefs to the court. And what my argument to the trial judge was that they have a orthopedic surgeon who says my client is injured as a result of this accident, it's proximate causation, and there is permanency. They have a life care planner who has agreed that there is, in this case, going to be future medical expenses, Judge. And I said that they have not a single expert who refutes my client's injuries. They don't have a single expert who says my client is exaggerating his injuries. They don't have a single expert who says that my client's injuries are somehow not related to this accident. What the defense counsel then did says, well, I'm not going to call any of those witnesses, and I'm going to argue that essentially the plaintiff is a fraud, he's malingering. He asked questions of Dr. Argentiano, which wound up, the court did strike those one or two questions, but he went into, do you discount writing reports? Do you have a financial stake in the case? Do you know how much money plaintiff's attorney is going to make out of this case? He suggested a conspiracy, basically, between the plaintiff, me, and one of the doctors, that this was all somehow a big put-on and that the plaintiff wasn't injured. And the court said, even despite the fact that there is no evidence anywhere that any of this is true, I am not going to limit him in any way from suggesting that the plaintiff is a malingerer and is not injured.
So after Rodriguez is decided, what do you view the rule to be with respect to, it wasn't, the term was solmanization was the term in that case, but secondary gain.
It, as I believe Justice Fernandez-Vina said, that you can ask questions. I think it's completely appropriate to ask a question that says, do any of the plaintiff's injuries fit an anatomic pattern? Because we see that in defense reports all the time. They say he has these complaints, but they don't fit an anatomic pattern. I did pinprick tests, and they were negative, and they should have been positive. We see these type of things in reports, and that's fair game. That's absolutely fair game. But absent a doctor saying that, medically speaking, I don't see a connection between the physical complaints and the diagnosis of a herniated disc or something, that the complaints don't match the anatomics, I don't think you can just turn around and call someone a malingerer or a fraud in some way and saying everything here is being exaggerated.
Under Rodriguez, it's case by case. It's case by case. There's no per se rule against questions that address.
There has to be a basis, though. Yes, there has to be some sort of basis. You can't just offer opinions about someone's state of mind You can't have an orthopedist give a state of mind opinion about a plaintiff that deals with motive. It's just not permissible. I think that blanketly that you cannot do, but you can elicit some of the same type of testimony that you would look for as the justice suggested.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Lamura.
Good afternoon, Chief Justices. Before I start, I wanted to address a couple of your questions, specifically about the page and line numbers and references, because I don't think counsel had them in his fingertips, and I think it may be worthwhile.
Try to keep your voice up, please.
Oh, sir. Sure. So, sir, regarding the life care planner, you would ask what evidence was before the court that would have allowed some of the testimony to come in. So first, I would draw your attention to testimony by the plaintiff. First, at transcript 5, line 71, he talked about the brace he has to wear. T5, page 73, he talked about his inability to move things around the house and his sexual interactions with his wife and the difficulties he was having interacting with her. T5, he also talked, I apologize, I don't have the page number, he talked about the gym membership that he needs to stretch and do the working that was
told
him.
Can any physicians testify as to what medical care and treatment he would read in the future?
And I think that, yes, actually two, Your Honor. I'll jump to those right now. Dr. A, I apologize, I don't want to mess up his name. On transcript 10, lines, page 12, line 21, he talks about the regular neurological visits he's going to need. Additionally to that, Dr. A also testified, excuse me, on page 119, line 20 to 120, line 2, he will have pain the remainder of his life. Dr. Lawler, he was stopped from questioning about the questionnaires and the basis of it, but that discussion was on T11 when he went to question.
Can I stop you, and I'm wondering sure. To continue this. When you say someone said they'll have pain, that's a distinct issue from what medical treatment they'll need, isn't it?
That's a great question, and that's actually one of the main things about the life care planner. That's why they're certified and they're an expert, is that they're providing opportunity of people that are in pain. They, most probability, use Tylenol. As discussed here, therefore, they will need Tylenol going forward. The price of Tylenol is X.
Right, but he says she, needing pain, the questionnaire that she was about to rely on went well beyond that.
Oh, so that also is a very good point, because the life care planner is not bound by this questionnaire. She did interviews for 4 hours with the plaintiff and his wife. She looked at all the medical records in it.
I understand. I get it. I get what she did. But when we're talking about her reliance on questionnaires and the presentation of those questionnaires to the jury as representing an opinion by a qualified doctor, in this case,
that's a separate issue. I was just trying to get the questions that you asked earlier.
I understand, but I know there's a lot of other things there, but we're talking about a very specific thing, and that is medical opinions that he specifically disclaimed that he could give within a reasonable degree of medical certainty were about to be brought in through this life care plan.
So you're talking about Dr. A's testimony?
Yeah, let's talk about him.
Sure. So Dr. A talked about oddly, it's not as specific as what that discussion is. He's going to throw it out as a possibility. His testimony that was barred in the 104 hearing.
Well, Lawler was barred.
Lawler was barred from asking questions about the questionnaire. Dr. A was testified when they were going through the transcript, because it was a demanding essay. So they were crossing out portions of the testimony. And in that testimony, he did say that people that have effusion, there is a probability of 10 to 15% of these people in the future having the need for further treatment. Now, that was stricken because of his comments in his report that say possibility.
Counsel, it's very helpful for you to come up and offer citations as you're doing, but you're here as an amicus, as a friend of the court.
Oh, of course.
So tell us, in the short time that you have, the principal position you're seeking to advocate with respect to this area of law.
So a life care planner should have the ability to not just be limited to that which is discussed by questioning discussions with the testifying or not testifying treating physicians. There's a 1,000-page manual that she talks about that talks, she's building a plan based upon a lot of items. Specifically, page 6 of that plan is well known, and it's talked about. They have a life care plan checklist. And what she talks about are items that don't have to be told about by a doctor per se, meaning that they talk about wheelchair accessibility, brace maintenance, furnishings at the house to make his life easier because of the difficulties he's having, drug supply, home care, facility care, transportation issues, maintenance, architecture.
So I understand that, but do you set, are you suggesting that there can be testimony on all of those issues when there is an absence of any testimony in the record that the plaintiff will need help in the future because of symptoms that will continue in futuro? You follow
me?
No,
there has to be a foundation, which is what we're saying here, is that the foundation has to be met, whether through the medical records of the plan, the doctors coming in and testifying about what it is. And that's kind of answering your question here, is that these are testifying witnesses. So it's not an 808 specific item here because of the fact that these experts, well, these treating physicians were actually supposed to come in and testify. Dr. Warler was precluded. He could have talked about all the questionnaires, and he wasn't asked at a discovery deposition about those items, but it was before them in his report saying they were going to need this future care. And
did you say that he wasn't permitted to testify concerning future needs because his report was not crafted in terms of a reasonable degree of medical probability? It was possibility. I'm trying to
understand. Oh, that's Dr. A. Dr. Lawler doesn't cushion it with the possibility. Dr. A cushioned it with possibility. He was, and their reports are in this, in your...
He didn't cushion it. He was asked a specific question.
Correct.
He understood the legal standard he had to for admissibility of his opinion, and he said, I'm not doing that because that's not my opinion.
That was Dr. A. That's not Dr. Lawler. Dr. Lawler did not provide that testimony anywhere and was actually about to testify to it under a reasonable degree of medical probability as was set forth and was precluded by objection based upon the prior discussion. And that is what was at transcript 11, pages 53 to 54. But the concept is, to answer the Chief Justice's question, is that you have to have a foundation. You have to be able to provide that foundation for an injury. Otherwise, the life care planner is basing upon nothing. But she can base it upon limitations from the conversation with the plaintiff and the family members. That's part of what life care planners do.
Sure, but the plaintiff does not have the expertise to know what medical treatment he might need. We're not talking about his future inconvenience or his impact on his relationship with his wife or whatever it may be. We're talking about a specific aspect of her opinion, which is the major chunk of the dollars here, and that is future medical care.
So that's the big chunk is epidurals. And that was the question that was asked of Dr. Lawler and got cut off. So he was going to say she needs future epidurals. That testimony is here. And that discussion was, unfortunately, also a speaking objection before. So we know what it was going to be. And it is in the transcript. But it was not allowed in. So assuming the foundation is laid, that in the future, because of pain that's permanent, you will need to have follow-up and epidurals, then she would be able to have it. Now, the beauty of this is she's testifying earlier than Dr. Lawler. So she was precluded before the opportunity even arose to question whether he was there and was going to give these points. The questionnaire...
What does that mean? Her opinion was challenged.
Correct.
Her opinion was challenged before she got on the stand.
Correct.
So why does it matter what sequence?
Sure, because there was no reason to say that this information wasn't going to come.
Well, nobody said, tell me if I'm wrong, nobody said, wait a minute, wait for Dr. Lawler. He's going to provide a partial foundation for what's in this opinion.
They should have. I agree with you that it wasn't done, but I'm here to protect the litigants and ask your honors what could come in here. And you've asked me that question specifically and where she should be allowed to do this. If you're coming in earlier and you're relying on evidence that is going to be from a testifying witness, it's that exception to 808. And then you're getting into the discussion part of 703. 703
specifically. So why not ask for an offer of proof?
That's fine as well.
Why can't counsel ask for an offer of proof outside the presence of the jury so the jury's not prejudiced in case it doesn't come in?
I actually think that's a great
idea. It's done all the time.
It's a great idea.
It's done every day in every courtroom.
I agree, Your Honor. I would stand
you're
up and say
friend of the court.
Dr. Lawler's going to come in later and he's going to say that all of these questionnaires.
So as a friend of the court, what you're saying is that there should be some testimonial foundation to support the life care planner.
Yeah.
If that wasn't present here, that's
I don't know if it was or wasn't because it wasn't allowed in. But the counsel could have given a proffer, as suggested, that Dr. Lawler is going to come in and corroborate everything in the questionnaire, because the questionnaire is just like a recording of a communication between the two of them, which is part of what a life care planner does.
Why is your view, if your view is there should be a testimonial foundation for the life care planner's testimony as to the medical needs of the future, why is that any different from the standard the trial court imposed by saying this is out because it doesn't have that foundation?
Well, I think there was a foundation, it just wasn't let in. For a second, I don't think that the life care planner is just based upon the future pain is enough, and also discussions with the plaintiff about what happened. So I don't want to say
you're really saying that it's enough to have the plaintiff say. To come in as a foundation for the medical components of this?
Not for future surgery, not for things of that nature, but they're allowed to provide their subjective complaints and what they do each day. So it's saying that he takes Tylenol to alleviate his pain and that it's alleviating pain, she's qualified enough
Tylenol, respectfully, is not going to cover
She was barred entirely. I'm not talking about this. I'm trying to say here that the foundation has to be laid, whether it be through whatever witness it is. It has to be provided. She can make the assumption and then go out and find that information. Based upon the question, I hope we're not questioning about getting the information from others, finding the numbers, because that's every life care planner does do the way that she went and called places and found that out, because that really has to be let in. That's 703 to the nth degree.
I don't think that's the issue in the case.
She'd have to call carpenters.
No, I don't think that's the issue in the case. No.
So then the issue regarding the medical care, I believe it should have come in this case, but overall, you have to have medical testimony to back up your life care planner's actions.
Appellate Division decision on remand say you'll have to sort out those specific bases on which all those facets of the opinion can or cannot come in?
Correct, which is why I don't think they made that the first part. It was the second part to
say go back
and
the whole thing's in, the whole thing's out. They said do the kind of more discrete analysis that you're suggesting.
Correct.
Okay. I think we have your position.
Okay. On the airbags, that was very well stated regarding the footnote 2 of the Tange opinion, where they go into the jury charge. That really is the juxta of this, is that they're taking the airbag and making it say the impact, especially the way that it was said to the jury in the opening and the close. So it was coupled with the airbag deployment as indicating something. I've been in a car accident, I was hit from behind, my airbags did not deploy, and I had two plates in my neck. So I know personally that the back hit from behind does not have the airbags go off. That said, a jury's not going to know that information. So it does, we believe that it should have an expert testimony if you're going to the point to do the aspect about the implication of the
impact. Does it go both ways? Can a plaintiff be asked, when the airbags did deploy, presumably they're not going to be asked if they didn't, can you ask your plaintiff, did the airbags deploy?
Okay. Yes, but with an exception for both sides. So if there's burns that were caused by an airbag, or if there was something that wasn't about the impact itself, but because of the impact.
Do you in your trials, when the airbags deploy, do you have them testify that the airbags deploy?
I do not. But that's personally me. I think that there's enough usually in other cases that I don't need. No, I don't know. Your Honor, I also wanted to address. You had brought up secondary gain. And Rodriguez, I think, was spot on regarding the fact that you can't go into the intent. And that is 100% what was going on here, is that the motives of the plaintiff, based upon asking an expert on a theoretical possible motive. I mean, the question actually was cushioned with, you'd agree with me that there's a theoretical motive. And the expert said, well, if the key word in that is theoretical. You shouldn't be able to ask questions that could prejudice and poison a jury that have no basis in fact or proof anywhere. It really should be precluded. So that position is as well there. I know Your Honor wanted us to limit it to those three.
Counsel, we're at 15 minutes.
And I'll make it very quick, I promise. Okay. And that is, this was terrible. It was. I was objecting and banging the desk when I was reading this, because there were people calling each other liars. There was unprofessional conduct. There were things that were outlined here. Every once in a while, we need an opinion to remind us what we can and can't do. And these questions and telling people how to answer, limiting and taking the role of the judiciary into our own hands, all of the things that were laid out here are vitally important, because we don't always get an evidence lesson. And even with the CLEs that we go to, sometimes we need the court to just remind us. and put these things in print, that this is what we can and can't do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Miller, brief rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will only say this, with respect to the last point that Amicus Council made about the benefit of the court speaking to conduct that may have taken place at this trial has sort of been educational opinion for the bar. I think I started this argument this morning with the idea that the appellate division didn't do this on both sides. They really just did it on one side. And if the court is going to use this as an opportunity to discuss do's and don'ts, if we put it that way, it should be balanced, particularly if you're counting up the don'ts on one side and saying this is cumulative error. Shouldn't you look at the don'ts on the other side and see how they balanced?
I'm not quite sure I follow that argument. At one level, it sounds like a recipe for the Wild West in a courtroom. In order to decide whether there's cumulative error, we're going to assess how bad each side behaved, and that doesn't sound right to me. On the other hand, we have a judgment here. We need to make a determination whether the appellate division's judgment is correct, and I think we need to assess the issues that are in that case and not scour the record for potential misdeeds that are not part of their judgment.
I agree completely, Your Honor. I'm simply saying if you're going to do it on one side, I think in fairness it should be done across the board, because otherwise how can you determine that these five errors on one side are enough to accumulate to be unfair to plaintiff without seeing if there was something else on the other side? That's my point.
So you think there's a balancing test? If you do six bad things and they only do five, they win, but if you do seven and they do eight, then you win?
No,
Your
Honor.
Is that the standard that you're coming up with?
Not at all, Your Honor. I'm simply saying it's not a one-sided inquiry. That's what I'm suggesting. If we're going to go down the road of cumulative error, I think it should be an assessment of everything accumulates.
Is there any law that supports that notion, that to assess cumulative error when one party raises it, you got to tally both sides?
No, and in fact, I think the precedent from this court is that you don't count up errors. So I'm not suggesting that the court should adopt that or that Your Honor should count errors and say it's six here and four there.
At the end of the day, both sides are entitled to a fair trial. If, taking your hypothetical, or not even hypothetical, both sides are acting so badly that there wasn't a fair trial, then what do we do? Not recognize that?
That's not at all what I'm suggesting, Your Honor, either. If it is so bad on both sides that it wasn't fair, that's something Your Honors can consider. But if I might just go into an example. One of the critiques of the appellate division was the question about where the plaintiff was born. That he's born in a different country and came to the United States. And the appellate division talked about how that, some might think that had racist undertones, if I remember the passage in the appellate division opinion correctly. The defense counsel asked the defendant the same thing. So if it's bad for the defense attorney to have brought
out... The plaintiff's counsel asked the defendant. Or the defense counsel asked.
Defense counsel asked his own client. So in other words, he put both the plaintiff and his client in the same light. So if the court...
What was the sequence? Who asked? Who went first?
Plaintiff testified first, Your Honor.
Who asked the question first? I'm sorry.
Defense counsel asked both questions. He asked the plaintiff
whether he was
first.
From Colombia? Is that the question we're talking about?
Yes.
Whether he was born in Colombia?
Yes.
How would that be relevant to anything?
It's only relevant because the appellate division identified that as one of the dozen or so issues.
I understand, but how would that question? So they've identified it. Now tell me how that question in any way could possibly be relevant to the issues in dispute in this case.
It was getting, Your Honor, to the idea that the plaintiff, notwithstanding the fact that he was born in another country and came here, understood English.
You could have asked the question directly.
Right. Well, there are people who are born here who
Henry Kissinger speaks English quite well.
I don't think the question was problematic. My point was, it was asked for both of them. So if we're going to look at it being asked of the plaintiff as one of the things to add up, if it's the same thing on the other side, shouldn't that be part of this accumulation of errors? That was my point, Your Honor. I apologize if I haven't made it as clearly as it was in my head. I apologize.
We'll take the matter under advisement. We understand.